Just behave yourselves and act like men.
Now you start using your head! That's not love! That's 3 feet above your ass!
People will come, Ray.
Alright, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist.
We don't stink right now.
You play ball like a girl!
You're out of here!
There's no crying in baseball!
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
This is West Coast Bias.
Dynamite drop in, Monty. That broadcast school has really paid off.
Right. We are back.
Yes, we are.
Better than ever.
Well.
Well, at least 50% of us, possibly. Thank you for joining us once again. I am Adam Nelson.
And I am Samuel Paul, and this is West Coast Bias Baseball Podcast, and yeah, wow, that was quite the series. It was a lot of fun to watch. It was disappointing on my end. I will say this, that, you know, this is, I've said this before too, from former Commissioner Bargiamani, it's the game that is designed to break your heart. And my heart has been prepared to be broken all summer long. And ultimately, it wasn't. Yes, I am disappointed in the ultimate outcome of the season, but man, what a hell of a season, what a hell of a series. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it all the way through up until the very end. And as far as I'm concerned, that the biggest travesty of the whole thing was to have it end in such an unsatisfying, unceremonial manner. It was, it leaves a foul taste in the mouth, and it changes the dialogue to how great of a series it was to how bad of a call that was and how bad of a job that the umpires did overall. But neither here nor there. I'm not making excuses or blaming anything. The Giants lost that series for a number of reasons, and the umpiring ultimately really wasn't the reason.
Now, of course, you're talking about the NLDS, for those who may not be listening to this in a timely fashion, although it is under, still kind of old news now.
Living under a rock, yes. Well, the NLCS has already started at the time of this recording. We are awaiting game two. The Dodgers are behind 0-1 in the series so far.
140 years. Never played in the postseason. Well, there was some time in the 1880s or something that the Brooklyn Robins played the Giants. But for all intents and purposes, this was it. And I got to tell you, I mean, I was about as gleeful as I was when we won the World Series last year.
Oh, yeah. Well, it felt like the World Series. And in a lot of ways, this was, I mean, do you agree with Vin Scully that this was the most important, that game five was the most important game that the Giants and Dodgers have ever played?
Oh, certainly. And it's very important for me as a Dodger fan living in San Francisco, staring into a potential year of ridicule and misery and, you know, just constant proclamations of Giants fortitude. Alas, that will never happen, or at least not for another 360 some odd days. It was quite a game. It was it probably took years off my life.
Because when the Dodgers won,
when the Dodgers, I mean, not, you know, game five notwithstanding, when the Dodgers won, they won emphatically. When the Giants won, it was a very, very close game. I mean, I'm of course, look at that Max Scherzer game You know, not the closeout, but I mean, he pitched 10 strikeouts, 7 innings,
run. He pitched good enough to win. There is no doubt.
Everything about he possibly could have done, pitched a gem, and we lost. You know, Dodgers lost. You know, the good guys won, as you're wont to say. But
only if you're a fan of the Empire, yes.
It was very satisfying, yes, and slightly poetic in the sense that the one game, arguably, that you could say, because the one game that separated the Dodgers and the Giants in the regular season, well, it was one game, and there was that game in July when bases
in
loaded.
July.
Top of the, well, bases loaded, top of the ninth, full count, Darren Ruff swings, clearly swings. Gets
at
called
ball five.
Gets called no swing. Tie game. The game was over. Everybody knew the game was over. Game's over. Let's go home. No, we're not going home. Oh, now we got to play, and now we got to go into the ninth and all this nonsense. Poetic justice? Question mark?
No.
I think so.
No,
that
this
it all came
down
to one. If it did, it all came down to one.
If you're okay. if you're blaming your season on one blown call, you're looking at it wrong. If the Dodgers lost the West by one game, yes, but that wasn't the game that look at the Dodgers records in extra innings. Look at
poor.
Look at you know, there's any number of other games. There's two full months and a little bit
more
time to make up that game, and they didn't.
But like the old adage goes,
they even had three more outs that game
It never should have been the three outs.
The pitch before that call, that check swing on Ruff in July,
was a check swing? Do you think it was a check swing?
The one was a ball.
A check swing.
No, it wasn't a check swing, but it was also the call before was blown. It was already ball four, the one before. So there's two bad calls in a row there.
Well, in the same vein of you saying you can't look at one game or one at bat, same goes with the end of the NLDS. You know, Wilmer Flores. I mean, late night Lamont. Even though I hate saying that. Came up with a man on representing game-winning hit and almost hit one.
I was on my couch watching that game. I'm well aware of what happened, and it's one thing to have a bad call that changes the outcome of a game, and there's another thing to have a bad call in the game, in the season. I mean, it's very, very unlikely that the outcome would have changed had there been one more pitch. But the fact that it ends like that, everyone in the national media is talking about the bad call and not the great series.
I think people have gotten over that. I think people have gotten over the bad call.
No, there's still
we're in a bubble up here.
There's
certainly, but
there was a sign put up on a college football Saturday morning in a game in Atlanta where someone put up a sign that said Wilmer Flores didn't swing.
But he did cry while playing a baseball game, and he'll forever go down in history as the one man who cried. Many men have shattered femurs and dislocated, spines, and they didn't cry. This guy cried. I'll never forget that. So it was actually a little bit sweeter to see him make the final out as well, because that guy bugs me. Okay. But he was 0-2. I mean, come on. Scherzer gave him that 87-mile pipe, and he wanted to swing in that first pitch, and he didn't do it. And
it should have swung, and there's a lot of woulda, coulda, shoulda. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that the Giants lost because of that bad call.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good.
I just don't like that that it was a blown call that ended the season in such a...
It's not like it hasn't happened before.
It's just an unsatisfying manner, and sure. that the umpire didn't like acknowledge after the game, hey, look, I'm sorry, I blew that call. I'll do better
next
time.
Well, he said, look, he's like, in the moment, I thought he swung.
But
he didn't say he definitely swung.
He didn't say that he missed the call. He just said that's what he saw in the moment.
You know, umps can't really do that. Umps have to sort of even they have to stick together. They have
the
job comes first. Essentially,
what about the perfect game that wasn't?
Yeah, I know
that umpire acknowledged that he made a mistake.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. The call stands, but.
But that's egregious. But this wasn't egregious. This was the Giants were losing.
Egregious.
They were on their last leg. You know,
I haven't heard anyone disagree that Wilmer Flores didn't swing. Was it?
He still offered. It's not like he didn't offer at it. He still offered.
It's not a bunt.
It's not a bunt. I know, but still. Either way.
So are you of the opinion that any time a batter moves his shoulder in anticipation of a pitch, that is offering as a swing and is an automatic strike, regardless of where the ball is?
But I am under the opinion that, you are at the mercy of other people watching you. And so if you do twitch even the slightest... You have to accept, assume a certain level of responsibility.
This isn't football. You don't have to remain totally quiet.
And by the
in
way,
that, in that box,
back?
If you flinch in football, it's a penalty. In baseball,
sometimes it's a penalty.
If the bat moves, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But baseball has to I think now define. What this is going to be, because it doesn't happen a lot, but when it happens, it seems like it's being blown way out of proportion anyway.
Well, and look, but back in July when that happened, when the rough swing happened, I said, you know, I would love to see a rule change. Now, obviously, we're not going to do replays on balls and strikes, and that's why that a check swing replay isn't allowable, because it's arguing balls and strikes, and that's fine, but... And I still stand by it, even now. And especially now, it almost makes it a more salient point in the sense that if they can agree to let the managers use a challenge, use their only challenge, if it's either A, ending an inning, or B, ending the game, they should be allowed to use that if they want. And if it gets overturned, then they lose their challenge. End of story. It would almost never happen. You know, most teams wouldn't do it. Because it's very rare, like you said, but there should be a clause in there just in case.
Right.
I'm for that.
I will tend to agree with that. I would say that maybe, I don't know, splitting hairs or something, but I would say that arguing a check swing is not arguing, a ball or a strike. You're not contesting the call on the pitch. You're contesting, you know, whether or not that was an actual swing or not.
Yeah, and it's not an easy angle from first base.
It's not an easy thing to call no matter what.
Yeah, you have to be perpendicular with the batter. It's really the only way to see that bat.
But down the line, if you're standing down the line, you sometimes will have a much better angle to see how far that bat moved than does the home plate umpire,
which is why they appeal.
Which is the appeal. Now, when I was umpiring in Little League, we would often have a meeting with the other umpire to have like a sort of a system, an agreement on check swing appeals. That if there was an appeal, the home plate umpire, hey, if I point to you with my right hand, I need your help to see if that was a swing or not. If I point to you with my left hand, back up my call. Whether it was a swing or no swing.
A lot of times the ump knows, but he just kind of needs
because the catcher wants catcher thinks that he swung. Go ahead and appeal. Did he swing? Yes or no?
Right, and then tell this guy to F off. But I'm making a courtesy over here to first base. Yeah,
right.
Now, do they do that in the pros?
I don't know. I don't. It sounds like
something that they probably.
It was my one opportunity to talk to someone who had major league umpiring, a system that is. There's something I did not ask him or think to really ask him, but. That was also 10 years ago. So even if I did, I don't know if I necessarily remember exactly what he said.
Now, I mean, do you think that rule should be in place? I mean, there's going to be a new CBA agreement coming up this offseason.
Well, there is another
maybe
CBA.
Maybe expand the scope of challenges and
well, what I think you can if challenge. If you allow this particular challenge, though, then you're ultimately almost forced to have a rule book definition of what a swing is.
Bat head crossing the plane, right? I mean, going more than 90 degrees past the parallel with the front of home plate. I would imagine.
Yeah, and that is what the rule is in the NC2A baseball rule book, but the Major League Baseball rule book does not have a explicit rule defining a swing.
There's no actual rule about
that. There's no actual rule. That's one of the main controversies and points that I've heard in the discussions over this play in the NLDS. Hmm. Is that there is no defined check swing rule in the Major League rulebook. So it's completely up to interpretation. And
well, I mean,
it's up to interpretation. You know, it's like in that circumstance. Why is it up to the first base umpire to end that series? It shouldn't happen like that.
Well, unless going to end the series.
Unless it's a play at first base, okay.
Well, but, all umpires are equal, right? Sometimes the crew chief is on second base. Sometimes he's in
left
field.
They do rotating. No, I'm not saying that there has to be a specific, but I
each
think,
one has the same amount of power to make a call if he
but
deems
not,
it necessary.
Not in that situation. Yeah, there's a potential for every umpire on the field to make the last out call if there's a play. You know, this was about a check swing. I mean, you know. To read the room, I don't think there was anyone in that stadium that wasn't expecting, you know, another pitch. I mean, Sergio himself, when he saw the call, looked surprised before he looked like really excited that he had done it. He was like, oh my God, he really called that a swing? And then, won.
Yeah.
It was no one. Was expecting the game to end there, and that is why it was so unsatisfying. It's like if you would have swung a real swing at a bad pitch, fine. He didn't swing. He didn't mean to swing at it. It wasn't a strike, and that was the end of the game.
But well, you know, I will say, and I'm surrounded by Giants fans. They were a bit salty about that, about the check swing or the swing for a little while, but then they most of them admitted that, yeah, no, we had way too many opportunities that game to win the game. We didn't get it done. We scored 3 runs in the previous 18 innings. You had 2 games to
six
to
runs
kick the
in the
out.
Last 36 yeah. innings.
2 games to kick the Dodgers out. Couldn't get it done. And, you know, to Ruff's credit, Ruff was quoted afterwards as saying, But, you know, speaking about how the game ended, he said, but a check swing earlier in the year helped us out too. So it's kind of funny how it comes down to those two events. And, you know, that's pretty, because he knows.
Yeah.
And if the Dodgers win by one game, that means the Giants lose and they're going to the wild card. And there's no guarantee they even beat the Cardinals to even make it to the NLDS. So it's all relative. You know, it all evens out.
It is absolutely relative. And, you know, ultimately, that's why this game is such a game of averages. Of course, you know, when you have a coin flip like that, but, you know, even if that is true, that the game hinged on two blown check swing calls, well, that sucks even more.
Well,
because
okay, but
again,
but
it's the umpires
point,
hijacking
the whole point
the
is that
story.
It didn't. The whole point is that it didn't come down to two check swings.
Yeah.
It came down to a lot more. Like, Doval, the, you know, triple-digit flamethrower, only throwing, what, two fastballs in the ninth inning? The inning that the Dodgers took the lead, and against a guy, Cody Bellinger, who has, I believe it's something crazy, like 12 hits on the season of 95 mile an hour and faster on the season. He just throws him a healthy diet of sliders.
There's something else going on there. I mean,
he was tired,
and part of the reason why he had been up and down this season is because he had some control problems, and he had just hit Turner to put him on base.
Yeah,
and
Gavin Lux smoked that, you know, single through the hole.
Right, so there's something going on, and it wasn't Duvall necessarily throwing a steady diet of sliders.
It was though.
Buster Posey was the one
that was calling.
It was asking 100%. For him. So I think there was, and Buster Posey knows what Bellinger does with off-speed pitches.
I know. Well, so, but the only thing I could think of is that, but he also knows what he does with, or what he doesn't do. And actually, I'm looking at now 10 hits on 95 miles an hour or faster on the entire season. But he must have known because Doval pitched two games before that. Sure, he had, you know, 2 days off, but the guy's young. He's a kid. He doesn't have the old man strength yet. You know, he's not really used to getting stretched
There's you know, and then there's, of course, the he is young and is also, this is a high pressure situation.
High pressure innings,
there's all sorts of adrenaline, and I guarantee you that game five, ninth inning adrenaline is a lot different than game two game three ninth inning.
Sure. So I think he must have known that, and he must have, you know, I think back to 2016 or Aroldis Chapman in the World Series when, Joe Maddon just kept putting him out there. And he was done, man. Toward the end, he was throwing 87 mile an hour sliders,
and no fastballs.
He had nothing left.
And this was also Dusty Baker's mistake in 2002 with Rob Nen. Rob Nen had a dead arm. He had a rotator cuff injury, and he was out there just throwing cheese.
Shucking, yeah.
And he couldn't hold the game after he took Russ Ortiz, who was dealing, you know, and Rob Nen just didn't have it for that ninth inning, and they came back and won. And it just, you know, this is a old trope with overused closers at the end of the game. It doesn't matter, you know, necessarily how good they are or how much experience they have. If you overuse a guy who throws 100 miles an hour with a wicked slider, throwing a wicked slider is notoriously, historically hard on the arm.
Yeah, well, so it's throwing 100 mile an hour gas, I would imagine.
Yeah,
too,
it is. I mean, for all the research that's out there, throwing a baseball is a relatively unnatural way of throwing.
It's one of the worst things you can do, throwing overhand. Throwing underhand supposedly is actually not hard.
Or even three quarters sometimes is a lot better for your arms. It's
like
a lot
your boy,
similar.
Rogers or whatever.
Well, I mean, think of like a javelin throw. something that is far more ancient than throwing a round rock. You know, some of the javelin is a different technique, and it does not put nearly the strain on the arm as it as does throwing.
Well, if you throw 100 javelins, maybe, but
I don't hear too many of javelin, you know, Olympic javelin track and field people who have like crippling arm injuries.
Well, but yes, because you don't hear any news about Olympic javelin throwers.
But even the ones that they're irrelevant make it,
to the world until every 4 years. Now, and that's no shade on javelin throwers. Javelin's dope and it's super cool. It is fun to watch. But three of the exact same pitch, though? Yeah, sure, he missed the first one. Sure, he missed the second one. And I know they're trying to pitch him inside because they're playing the shift on Bellinger. But by the way, hitting that slider through the shift, that was pretty.
Yeah.
You know, it's always, he did not get cheated. He earned that hit. And, you know, after the game, Kapler even said, he said Bellinger wasn't able to get under it until that one swing. Yeah, that's kind of how it goes. He said, so I thought it was a fine pitch call. You know, he's backing up his team. I'm glad he didn't, you know, he's not trying to.
No,
you know, he didn't backstep anything. He didn't, you know,
No, and there's no reason to, because the reason why the Giants lost was because the team OPS in the series was 513.
Yeah, a solo shot here and there isn't
going to win a game. With a 182 batting average and an on-base percentage of 211. They got away from what had made them such a successful team during the season. They just didn't hit the ball. They didn't grind at bats. They were all trying to hit the home run. And when you try to hit a home run, you don't. It's kind of like the whole headspace is why home run derbies take guys out of their home run swing or put them in.
Yeah, like Juan Soto actually made it better.
Exactly, it's because you're focused on hitting the home run. If you just take a batting practice approach at the home run derby and just try to put a good swing on every single ball and hit it as hard as you can, you're going to hit a lot more home runs. You're also going to get a lot more base hits.
It's actually exactly like in the wild card game against St. Louis. Bellinger stole two bases on Yadier Molina, which was amazing to see because nobody runs on Yadi, even still to this day. He's like the least catcher in baseball.
He's amazing.
But it was that last stolen base in the bottom of the ninth when Chris Taylor was up at the plate. He stole second. And then that, it was able to relax Taylor. So then, and he even said, he's like, I wasn't going for the big shot after that. All I was doing was trying to get a single. And then, of course, we know he ends up smashing the ball into the seats.
He tore the cover because, off.
Exactly right. Like, when you're able to calm down a little bit, you end up actually hitting for more power.
You get a better at bat. If you're just trying to get a base hit and you hit the ball hard, good things happen.
Yeah.
That is baseball. Throw the ball, catch the ball. You know, if you do all three of those things well, it is a simple game. Exactly. You do all three of those things well, you're going to win the majority of the games that you play. And for the most part, you know, you can say that about both the Giants and the Dodgers for at least 110, 109 games. That's what these two teams did. But the Giants got themselves in a position where if they allowed the Dodgers to win or to score even one run, they lost.
Now, with his big hit on Thursday, Bellinger now has three career go-ahead hits in winner-take-all games, tying Gene Tennis and one other famous the real Mr. October. I know Reggie is Mr. October, but this one guy is really the real Mr. October because he has like all the records. You know who I'm talking about?
Derek Jeter?
No. Bernie Williams is better than Derek Jeter in the postseason. No. Manny Ramirez, Mr. Home Run. I mean, he leads like all those categories, doesn't he? That could have been the trivia question, but now Bellinger is tied with those guys. I mean, that is good company. You know, and Charlie Steiner during the broadcast said it was the biggest hit of Bellinger's career.
Yeah?
I don't know. I might have to beg to differ. I mean, it certainly was a huge hit. But last year, you know, Game 7 NLCS in against Atlanta. Not in Atlanta, but...
But
we were down 3-1 in that series. Bellinger comes back, hits the go-ahead home run that put the game and the pennant away. I mean...
Taking nothing away from that, it's that that wasn't against the Giants. in the postseason. No, I mean, if you think about... In terms,
and there were no fans there.
In the terms of the 130 plus year rivalry, the names on both sides that stand out the most are the ones that did well against the other team.
Sure.
So the names that stand out in San Francisco lore are the names that always did well against the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And the names that the Dodger names that stand out are the ones that always just seem to just crush the Giants. And I think that's how you win legend status in San Francisco, is you win games against the Dodgers and vice versa. It's just, that's why I think he said it was the most important, or the biggest, not necessarily the most important, but the biggest at bat in his career, is because it was against the Giants. It was the postseason. It was game five of the postseason against the Giants. It was pretty sure. Huge.
Yeah, think of Mike Piazza. Oh, yeah. You think of all these guys. Now, the Giants seemed a little bit salty at the stadium there after Belly hit that that go-ahead single. They started playing Pink Floyd's Money. I don't know if you caught that. Did you catch that?
No, I
Which
didn't.
Is weird, because he's like one of the only guys without like a long contract. He's, you know, he just has like a one-year contract to avoid arbitration. Sure, it's 16 mil, but I mean, he has a 2017 MVP, you know, 2019 MVP, 2017 Rookie of the Year. I caught that. I don't know if anybody else.
I don't know if that was necessarily directed at Bellinger in particular. Maybe the whole team. I mean, that payroll. Yeah. I mean, you're paying a guy $30 million to stay away. So,
not necessarily by choice, but you know,
this is madness.
The Giants. It's the 9th NL West in team history. First since 2012. Franchise record, 107 wins. You know, all in all, it's a good season. I'm sure you're excited for next season. The real question is, are you going to pay Chris Bryant? That's the real question.
Well, I'm nervous about next season, not necessarily because I don't think the Giants will do well, but it's the CBA that is looming.
That pesky designated hitter.
Well,
among other things.
Among other things, I just hope that there's a season and it starts on time. That's what I'm nervous about. Is I don't know, and you know, there's a lot of
that's not
a lot of work to be done in terms of signing a whole lot of free agents, or not, and it'll be interesting because. You know, because of the CBA, are players going to hold out until after the CBA is worked out before signings happen, or are they going to get, you know, their jobs secured before? I mean, who
knows? Free agents for the Giants: Chris Bryant, Kevin Gausman, Brandon Belt, Anthony DeSclafani, Alex Wood, 2021 club options: Buster Posey, Johnny Cueto, Wilmer Flores. Who's the most important to keep?
Buster Posey. I think the just the fact that he one out of every five starts that he makes in the postseason is a shutout, I think speaks volumes. I think
he's looking old, man. He's looking pretty. The guy's younger than me, and he's got gray hair everywhere. He's looking kind of tubby too. He's looking like a little bigger.
He's got the dad body.
A little dad body going on there.
I think I'm not necessarily worried about that. I think he's got one or two more years, and it's totally worth keeping him on. just because of the experience, the knowledge, and just the presence that he brings to the Giants clubhouse. I think he's the key piece right there. Everything else will fall into place around Buster Posey. That's what it's been like since second half of 2010.
But what do you give him? I mean, I'm sure he'll take a slight pay cut just to stay, but
I don't know.
Our team's clamoring for a 35-year-old catcher.
I don't know that you break the bank on him. I think that you, if he's willing, you keep him at kind of the same level that he is, maybe a slight pay raise.
Let's make it $22 million.
Yeah, $22 million makes $22 million pick up the option for 2022, and then you pay him $25 million for 2023, and then see what happens beyond there.
Yeah, that's fair. Bryant is gonna want like $200 million.
Chris Bryant is gonna be expensive to stay just because of his agent, but he has expressed that he would like to stay here, and I think that'll help.
That goes a long way, especially when he's got a taste of winning and a taste of that rivalry, which is
yeah,
nice, you know.
It is, and he performed well in the postseason.
Every time I see him, he's getting a hit.
Yeah,
every game. Like, it's just crazy.
He had an outstanding postseason, and he needed to in order for the Giants to win. But of course, that's also predicated on rest of the team getting hits, which half of the team didn't.
But you kind of got to take care of him, I would imagine. I'm looking at his WAR. Okay, he had a 3.30 WAR in 2021. I thought it would maybe be 4 or so. I would imagine, I mean, I know he came a little later to the Giants, but he's playing really well here because he had like a slow period in the middle. He started off great, slow, and then started to finish great. Yeah. I think that's worth one win, maybe two, the addition of Chris Bryant.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that's the season right there.
Yeah.
So that's, I think you got to pay this guy whatever he wants, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think of the list that you just read, the least likely to come back will be Johnny Cueto.
Sure.
I don't think we'll see him in a Giants uniform next
$22 million, 2021 club option. Brandon Belt?
Well, Brandon Belt, that'll be an interesting question. I've expressed my thoughts on Brandon Belt on this show before. I'm not going to get into that right now, except to say that the last 2 months or so of the season was up to the point where his hand got broken in Colorado, was the Brandon Belt that I think
you were always hoping.
This is the Brandon Belt that I was always hoping and expecting to see. It's like, where was this hitter all this time?
Dead. He's dead to the world, man.
I mean, I think a lot of Brandon Belt's woes had to do with very unlucky injuries. Not being here nor there, I have no idea what's going to happen with Brandon Belt. I would be a little bit surprised if the Giants gave him a multi-year contract.
I'd be shocked.
I would be less surprised if maybe give him one more year. I think that
he's getting $16 million.
I think that if the Giants sign Bryant to a big contract, I think we don't see Belt and Bryant goes to play
first base
the majority of the time. Just because what little that we saw of his defense at third base, had a little bit of a wild throw going across the diamond.
Well, he's getting thrown in the left field, center field, third base. It's not that easy.
I think he was far better in the outfield than he was in third base from the games that I watched of him. I think that he goes to play first base. I think he can do very well there, and that happens only if they don't bring Bell back.
I think you got to get rid of Belt. That guy is, he had 29 jacks and he had he finally came to life a little bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's just a walking liability.
He seems to be somewhat injury prone, unlucky or not, and he's inconsistent, and we'd love to see him, you know, hit 30 home runs a year, and he probably would have this year, but, you know, strange bunt attempt in Colorado when you're the hottest hitter around and you break your thumb and then you're out for the rest of the season.
All right, find me some good players, living players.
Yeah, it's who bunts in Colorado? you know, now the one thing obviously that where I don't think the Giants can sustain for next year, at least not 107 wins, is that they were number one in one-run games and pinch-hit home runs. So, I mean, if you can do that again, hey. But
the pinch-hit home run thing, that's regression, amazing. But I think a lot of that speaks to the approach that the Giants took at the plate and why they were such a successful team is because they went in there, they took their at-bats, they grinded. They got pitch counted up. They saw a lot of pitches, and they put a good swing on the pitch that they were looking for.
Now, this shouldn't be a controversial statement, but Gabe Kapler, shoe-in manager of the year.
Oh, yeah. Why not? I mean, is there any other National League manager that did a, you know,
Dave better, Roberts?
Or unexpected job?
Okay, well, unexpected, certainly. He's got that locked down.
Dave Roberts did a fine job, but, you know, he
always does a fine job, so it's par for the course.
But he's also got the biggest payroll.
No,
he's
he
got
the most,
tell us like $250 million.
Yeah, it's not the biggest.
And he's got like an all-star lineup every single night. Batter after batter is just unrelenting. And then you've got four Cy Young pitchers on the staff and paying another one to stay away. You know, it's
all right. I could see. Give it to Gabe Kapler. The guy he's the miracle worker. It was Andy Sullivan over there. This guy.
I am the goddamn manager, and I'm going to run this goddamn team.
And he did it well. You know, rats off to Gabe Kapler. And by the way, what's up with all these former Dodgers just killing it?
Oh,
you know,
man.
Farhan Zaidi, Gabe Kapler. I mean, obviously. Jock Peterson, Jocktober, Kike Hernandez.
Yeah,
the
hot take is that the biggest postseason acquisition for the Giants this past year was Kike Hernandez going to the Red Sox. I think that this season plays out completely different if Kike Hernandez is on the Dodgers in 2021.
Kike Hernandez's 13 hits in that four-game period, extended the record for most in a four-game span in the postseason to 13. Randy Arozarena last year had 11, and that was tied with Marquise Grissom, Hideki Matsui, and Billy Hatcher. But Kike's 8 extra base hits in his last four games also tied Hideki Matsui and Mr. October himself, Reggie Jackson, for the most over a four-game span in postseason history. Not to mention, he now has the most total bases in a four-game span in a single postseason, passing Carlos Beltran from 2004. Hideki Matsui, Reggie Jackson, and your boy Pablo Sandoval bringing up the rear with 23. But yeah, Kike sitting at 29, man, total bases. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
It really is quite amazing.
And it just seems like all these guys, you know, they're all over the postseason, all these former Dodgers, and
what happens if you have a good team for a sustained period. Eventually, players move on for a variety of reasons, and they tend to show up on, if they're good players, they're gonna show up on good teams.
Jake McGee
doing
as
well
on the Giants.
Yeah.
Because these guys are not necessarily bench guys, but they're like platoon guys unless there are some serious injuries when they're wearing Pantone 294. But when they're on a different team, they're everyday starter, starting center fielder of the Red Sox, Kike, and making some flashing that leather and making some really great highlight reel catches.
There's no doubt. And I was very pleased not to see him in the Dodgers lineup in 2021. I think it went a long way. That guy just seemed like every time he was up against the Dodgers, it was or against the Giants, it was a 2-run double or a 3-run home run.
Right.
You know, and it's like, couldn't get this guy out, and I'm glad we didn't have to this year, especially the way that he seems to be raking it right now. So
now, is this, I'm trying to think, it seems like an NL West team has lost in the division series like almost like a decade now, maybe not that long,
but not quite a decade, but the better part of a decade. There's certainly the last 5 years and 6 years if you want to count 2016, but yeah. In the past 5 years,
2016, the Dodgers won the division series in 2016.
Yeah, but the Giants lost the Cub that particular year.
The Giants made. That's right. I forgot they were even in the postseason.
There's been several times in the past 20 years that the Giants and Dodgers could have met in a postseason game, but the stars didn't align until this year. But
and now we know who the better team is and will always be, I guess. So that settles it for the next 100 years. The next 100 years, it settles it? All right.
No.
All right. You heard it here first.
I didn't put that away. No, they're not the best team ever.
So who was it? So Giants?
No, it was
in 16.
Giants in 16, but that was 6 years ago, not five.
Right. So, yeah, Giants in 16.
So, in 17, it was the Diamondbacks.
That's right. Those Diamondbacks were good.
Yeah, stay out of our pool celebrating.
Yeah, that was good. Get it out of the ocean like I'm wearing right now.
Stay out of the pool!
That was great.
The old man yells. That was great. Yes.
Get off my lawn.
Rockies in 2028 lost to the Brewers.
2028? This guy's predicting the future.
Oh, yeah. 2018.
Wow. Sammy says here, I guess. That was great. Yeah, those are some good. That's the year we went 163. Yeah. And that was pretty tough, right? Wait.
Yeah.
No, it couldn't have been. Oh, yeah, because then they ended up getting the wild card, I guess. Oh, how time flies.
And then 2019, the Dodgers lost to the Nationals,
who ended up winning it all. And that's the thing, the Dodgers lost to the Cubs for the championship series in 2016, and they ended up winning it all. It hurt a little less when the Cubs won, just because, hell, I mean, you know, they were due. But yeah.
And then in 2020, the Padres lost to the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And then the
2021. The San Francisco Giants. Yeah. Lost to the Dodgers. Now the Oakland A's
were in the news.
Well, they have a bit of a precarious future coming up.
Well,
and I sort of do unofficial polls with people in the for A's fans. You know, I know a good amount of A's fans. I'm an adopted A's apologist. I'll say I enjoy going to A's games. I like the old Coliseum. You know, the old Coliseum reminds me of
you're one of the very few
old Dodger Stadium. I like it, man. It's grimy. It's look when it's packed. It's not fun. You know, when the Raiders played, like you go to a Raider game, it is brutal there. The facilities, you know, the troughs and everything, shoulder to shoulder, you know, cocks out and everything like that. That's not always fun, but it is a bit nostalgic. For me, Dodger Stadium in the 80s and 90s was pretty trashy and rundown and big.
Candlestick
smelled like
peanuts. The same way. Absolutely.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I understand the appeal and where you're coming from that. But
now, you know, I know there's rumors that they're going to go the way of the Raiders and go to Vegas.
Yeah, well,
is there any substantial truth to this?
Well, I did find an article a few days ago on thescore.com. And saying that the A's are expected to announce finalists for a stadium in Las Vegas after the World Series.
Like new stadiums or existing stadiums?
A new stadium. A ballpark could cost $1 billion.
It's chump change for Vegas.
Well, perhaps. I mean, this is a tremendous infrastructure you know, investments happening in Las Vegas at the moment. But, they've you know, the A's in May, they called the Oakland Coliseum a non-viable option for the future. They know they need a new stadium. They're still trying to work out something here at the Howard Terminal area in Oakland, but there's, you know, nothing has been finalized. So they're starting to look outside the area.
That'd be a shame. I don't want to see them go personally. It's sad for Oakland. They lost everybody.
Yeah, and the A's have been here since 1968. They've won 4 championships, and the last one, of course, being 33 years ago,
to the day.
32 years ago. They didn't win 32 years ago, but they were playing in their last World Series that they won on this day. It was a historic day. Game 3 of the 1989 World Series on October 17th.
Why was it historic?
Well, there was a 7.1 earthquake that hit the Bay Area just outside of Santa Cruz. Was the epicenter, and it rocked the Bay for a good 15 seconds at 5:04 p.m. And yours truly was sitting in the upper deck, Candlestick Park, waiting to watch my very first World Series game. And it didn't happen for like another week and a half after that.
That must have been terrifying. Candlestick Park. I mean, that must.
It was, you know, that
bizarre. Did you? I'm sure you felt a 7 feel. A 3-5, you probably wouldn't even feel because of all the stands and everything.
Well, at first, when it first started, because of the noise, we thought that it was people getting excited and stamping their feet,
right?
And you know, but then. Stadium started to move in very unnatural ways, and for seemingly long time I was sitting in right field, the right field kind of upper deck bleachers, and the right behind the foul pole, and it was moving from side
swaying
to side.
The foul pole. Wow!
It was swaying, and the all of the glass and the press box and the luxury boxes, you know, were sort of wobbling in and out, and it was an intense few seconds, and then it stopped, and it was quiet, and there was no power in the stadium.
Wow.
A few people stood up and immediately left. And a few others sort of waited around to see what was going to happen.
Hey, it's World Series baseball here, you know.
I mean, yeah. And then it was people around. I mean, this was the late 80s, so there was no cell phone coverage to speak of. I mean, there was a little bit, but no one had one in the stands. Certainly not,
right.
but people had little transistor radios, and people had the little portable TVs pulling, you know, the thing. So as soon, you know, with the whole nation watching, because it was the World Series, they had the blimp and all those helicopters, you know,
the
people started getting the reports, you know, of the magnitude of the quake, and then someone yelled, "The Bay Bridge has collapsed," and people started saying, okay, well, this is thing, and we started seeing a lot more people go. I think it took 20 minutes, the lights came back on, everyone started to see the pictures that everyone else who was watching at home was seeing.
What, are they projected and, on the jumbos?
Yeah, once they came on, they showed the picture of the section of the Bay Bridge that collapsed. It showed in the distance the fire in the marina here in the city. And showed sort of not great pictures, but of just total devastation in the East Bay where the freeway had collapsed. And that's when people really started to leave. I mean, everyone had come out onto the field that was there, the police, you know, cars on the field, and everyone was sort of like figuring out what to do. They finally told everyone to go home, so everyone went home. But it was certainly a day I'll never forget as a 12-year-old baseball fan ready to see the first World Series game live and in person. And
And you're like, I'll never go back again.
No,
that's pretty amazing.
I ended up going to game 3 and 4, but when they played them, you know, 2 weeks later, but it was different situation.
And how did the Giants end up doing?
Not very good. We don't talk about that. And that's ultimately the reason why I'm not an A's fan. I don't, you know, at this point I'm over it. I don't mind if they do well, but I don't actively root for the A's. But I still don't want to see them leave the area. I think Oakland's got to get its act together and keep the team here.
They should. I mean, they really need to. I mean, I don't know if they can retrofit this park. I think they've tried a million times, and I think the Coliseum, I should say. The stadium, it's gigantic. They're going to have to build something new. Doesn't look like they're going to get it done, although I hope they do. It would be nice.
The owner is one of the richest men in the world. He could afford to do anything that he wants to do, but he just doesn't want to spend money. So, you know, whatever. I mean, it's his money. It's his team. He can do, I guess, what he wants. But it would be bad for the area. It'd be bad for all of those Oakland A's fans, wherever they exist. And it wouldn't be the first time and probably won't be the last time that franchise moves its location.
And that brings us to this week's Ignoble Award of the Week. This week's Ignoble Award is brought to you by Robinson Canoes. Robinson Canoes are a premium small boat manufacturer specializing in watercraft made from only the finest stenozolol-enriched caoba wood from San Pedro de Macari in the Dominican Republic. Each vessel is handcrafted by a team of 24 steroid-laced strongmen and manufactured right here in the USA. With factories in Seattle and New York, there has never been an easier time to own your very own canoe, and shipping is always free in the continental US. So when you're looking for your next canoe, step up to the plate and visit RobinsonCanoes.com and make your next outdoor adventure a home run. What do you got for me this week? I must have a spit take over there.
I was not ready for that pun.
Tony, we're doing sponsors now because, you know, I gotta make that sweet, sweet cheddar.
Yes, so this week's Ignoble Award is, I would say, historically ignoble.
Real.
Yes, now I have to find my place here because I think something moved while I was laughing during that ad read. Okay, so 470 teams in the history of baseball at the 100 game mark have been 58-42 or better.
Okay.
470 teams. Only two have finished the year under 500.
Really?
Yes, one was the 2012 Pirates.
Okay, yeah, I vaguely remember that one.
Yes, and the other one, our recipient of the Ignoble Award, is the 2021 San Diego Padres.
Your 2021 What happened to Slam Diego? What happened to these guys?
I don't know. Something happened around October. No, it wasn't October. It was August. Something happened in August 11th. August 11th was the last time that the... that was the peak of the Padres season. They started their backslide on October. I don't know why I'm talking October. It is October. Huh. This was in August. In August 12th, they started their backslide. And I don't know what, something must have happened. If there's any Padres fans listening to us that may know what happened in the clubhouse around the team at that time, something happened and they just stopped playing as good.
Yeah, Mo, that team sure did suck last night. They just plain sucked. I've seen teams suck before, but they were the suckiest bunch of sucks that ever sucked.
Now, it might be some sort of chemistry problem, but I know Eric Hosmer has been, I don't know if he's been overtly vocal, but it's almost common knowledge that he doesn't really want to be there. And it is kind of strange, you know, there are reports of him sort of sitting alone in the locker room, eating alone, doesn't go out with the team, stuff like that. But when you know, when you watch the games, it seems like they're okay. But you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Well, winning covers up a lot of scars,
sure,
and a lot of flaws. And once the Padres stopped winning, I'm sure it stopped being fun.
Right, and then it's just a slippery slope, snowball.
Exposes all of the flaws and all of the rifts that exist. They just get exaggerated, and it makes it much harder to come back.
You know, they're not like the Angels, who have great bats but have zero pitching. Padres have great pitching, and they have really good bats. And so, so I guess the common denominator must just be chemistry. Well, now, obviously, the manager is no more.
Right.
But A.J. Preller controls that whole organization. Didn't even let Tingler pick his managers. Didn't let him pick his bench, his pitching coach. He didn't let him pick any of them. So it's no wonder this guy is on the outs. He doesn't have anybody supporting him.
And the same thing happened, I think, with Gabe Kapler in Philadelphia. That he was picked as manager there, but he wasn't allowed to bring a coaching staff with him.
Yeah, so it's like, what's the point? Yeah. You know, it's like, do you trust me? Do you want me to do the job, or don't you?
Yeah,
it's kind of tough. I mean, Tingler didn't look like he always made all the right moves. It kind of looked like, you know, he seemed a little bit out of his depth, but at the same time, it's not for no reason. You know? So you almost can't blame him.
But you still, as a manager of a baseball team, you're also managing personalities. And at some point, he lost the locker room. You know, with your coaching staff that you want or not, it's still your job to manage the clubhouse. And if you lose the clubhouse, you know, nothing. That blow up we talked about between Machado and Tatis. He was nowhere to be seen. Where was he?
Well, right. Yeah.
You know, I you know, this one report I saw said that he was busy getting ejected, talking to the umpire, but I didn't see any of that. You know, that wasn't what was reported on. What was reported on was the blow up in the dugout in the middle of the game, visible to anyone who was looking.
I mean, that happens a lot, especially with really good players. You know, I mean, sure. Of course, you remember Bryce Harper going after, it was that Hunter Strickland?
But that was between two teams. That wasn't internally.
No. That was like, who was it? Papelbaum? Who was it? No, he was on his team. Who was it?
It wasn't Strickland. That's the thing.
Yeah, it was Strickland, right? Yeah.
Strickland was a Giants pitcher, and he charged the
No. Back when he was on the Nationals. Anyway. Yeah. It happens, you know.
Yeah, no, I know.
Inter-team fighting and all that stuff, you know.
I know it
happens.
That's
why I'm a little worried if Trevor Bauer comes back, because, I mean, obviously I want that 5, 6, 7 wins above replacement player on the team. But if he's not, if he doesn't, like, a cohesive fit to the spirit and the culture of the team, then, yeah, I mean, Cy Young winner be damned. I mean, if it's not good for the team, it's not good. And no, we still won 106 without him. So
there was you know, I remember hearing talk that many of the Dodgers players were glad that he was no longer on the team.
Yeah,
so
kinda tough.
You know, it's once you say something like that, you know,
it's hard to come back.
It really is.
That being said, Trevor Bauer has always been on the outs on like every team he's ever been on, going back to UCLA and even in high school. They would, you know, he was always the outcast. You know, this is why he still hates.
Abrasive personality, outspoken.
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe. I think it's just his social skills weren't always entirely developed, and he was a little bit of like a nerd. And, you know, in the jock culture, especially in high school and college, you know, you kind of have to be a part of the team. You know, you can't really, if you do things your own way, you're going to get ostracized a little bit. And this is why he still hates Gerrit Cole to this day. You know, supposedly Gerrit Cole would like call him out on like the team bus and like ridicule him in front of the whole team. And, you know, and Trevor Bauer talks about it as, you know, it made him a better person. It also alienated him more from other people. And he admits it himself, you know, at least like in a lot of those older videos that he used to post. And it would alienate the team because he would do things his own way and he would need to do things his own way. And the bottom line is a lot of guys do this now. A lot of guys do these exercises that he does. A lot of guys warm up with that weird rod, that tension rod thing that he uses, and, you know, using a heavy ball. It's like everybody does that now, you know, and he was like one of the first guys that would consistently do that. But anyway, like, you know, he has a weird personality, and that's, and especially now with, you know, there's a lot other worse optics going on, and would they accept him after they've, even something as seemingly innocuous as unfriending them on social media, that has ripple effects, especially nowadays. You know, all these guys are millennials. All these guys have grown up with this stuff. They're all young. Yeah. You know, it's all a big part of their lives, and that's not for nothing. So, yeah, I am a little worried about that because he's still on the books for 2 more years, and he has opt-out ability. But, like, why would he, you know, like, where else is he going to go? You know, like, you're going to leave a team with 106 wins? You're going to leave a team that's been to the World Series, you know, 3 out of the last 4 years? I mean, I doubt it.
I mean, he chose, I mean, it was a big whole thing. Where's Trevor Bauer going to sign? He made a whole big thing about it. He wanted to play for the Dodgers. I doubt that has changed too much.
I mean, he grew up a Dodger fan. You know, it's... But at the same time, and I guess he's kind of used to not fitting in, but the Dodgers are such a tight-knit unit, you know? There are a few additions, you know, Trey and Scherzer, but like for the most part, a lot of these guys have been on there for years.
Yeah,
and a lot of them are homegrown talent, exactly. Yeah, I mean, or they're talent
Kershaw
that got...
never pitched for another organization, so...
And God willing, never will. Yeah, so that's... it's we'll see. Yeah, I'm a little worried about that.
It'll be something to watch and talk about during the off season.
Now moving on to the NLCS, because we're already 1 game in, probably 2 games in by the time you're listening to this. We got Mad Max going this evening, Sunday night, which I believe they actually bumped up to 4:30 now, so we gotta wrap this up quickly. You know, I was hoping to get that win. I was hoping the Dodgers would get that first win and get the second win in Atlanta.
Well, you're always hoping. You're always open to win one of the first two on the road.
Yeah, and we tried the experiment with Corey Knebel starting the game off again, and then they got a run on a wild pitch, so I guess the experiment didn't really work. But, I mean, anyway, that, you know, they ended up only winning by 1 game, walked off in the 9th. The Dodgers' offense compared to the Braves offense is, I mean, it's almost not even comparable. You know, Freddie Freeman is arguably better than any one hitter on the Dodgers in terms of DRC plus.
There's only one Freddie Freeman.
Exactly.
Well, there's so many just dangerous Mookie Betts hitters.
Well, and
and the Dodgers lineup, it's crazy. Once they start scoring runs, it just doesn't seem like they stop.
Well, hopefully not. You know, while looking at both teams' DRC plus, which is the deserved runs created plus, where one is, you know, standard and anything, or 100 is standard, anything over 100 is better than average, anything below is below. Freddie Freeman has a 133 DRC plus on the season. And then there's only two other guys with 100 or more, and that's Ozzie Albies with 106. Austin Riley, who's just, I mean, where did he come from? I mean, he got the game-winning hit, obviously. I mean, this guy is dangerous. He's kind of like this year's Marcell Ozuna. So, you know, they have an Adam Duvall with sitting out right on 100. Dodgers have Trey Turner, Corey Seager, Justin Turner, Will Smith, Mookie, A.J. Pollock, all over 120, which is pretty impressive. But again, yeah, Braves don't have Ozuna. They don't have Acuna.
There's a lot gone wrong for the Braves this year. They overcame a lot of adversity. And ultimately, down the stretch, though, they were playing far better baseball than their record would necessarily indicate.
Sure.
And they didn't win a lot of games, as especially as compared to
88 games.
Yeah,
and they have home field. Yeah,
but they won. They won their division.
I know.
So if the Dodgers end up losing this division series or this championship series, are you going to be complaining that you didn't have a home field advantage all off season?
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad that you that
18 wins separate these two teams.
Yeah, no, they're need. I think,
and the team with the fewest wins gets home field. Yeah, I mean, I get it. It's fine.
Something is part of what happens when you win your division, and you know, next year, you know, it sucks that 106 games wasn't enough to win the division, but damn.
Yeah. Just,
you got to be better than the next best team in the division, and now maybe a reseeding of the playoffs playoff teams is necessary.
I know everybody's been talking about this reseeding, it's hard to argue it, but like you said, you know, you won your division, that should be worth something. And as much as it pains me to have to see the Dodgers on the road with 106 wins when no other team even came close, there's something to it. Now, what I would change in the future, and I hope that they do, and they probably won't, but do it like we talked about last year with the extended postseason last year and the extended wild card. If you're going to have a wild card game, make it a best of three, and the number one seed in that only needs to win one. You know, Dodgers should not have been playing the Cardinals. I mean, they should have been, in the sense that obviously the Cardinals won too, but Cardinals only won 90 games. I mean, come on. Yeah. You know, make the Cardinals win two, let the Dodgers win one. Or if a team, let's say, has 100 wins going in, they only need to win one. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like, I guess the scheduling, that would just be a nightmare. Because, like, do you book the hotel for two nights or one night? You know, I mean, I know, like, that's not fun for the travel scouts. No,
and it's
that,
also then I mean,
but it's more fair.
The difference, the 5 games between game 162, 5 days between game 162 and the start of the
division, yeah,
the division series. Yeah. That's a long time to wait already, and if you're going to extend that by, you know, another day or two, it's you know, everyone should have a day off before the playoffs start.
All right, then just abolish it altogether. Just get rid of it. I know they never will, but one game to determine 162 is just so silly. It just seems like such a waste. You know, I mean, it made for a hell of a spectacular ending with Chris Taylor's walk-off home run against the Cardinals. But, I mean, you know, that's not right. It's just not right. I don't like it. I know it gets a whole other market or two whole other markets involved in the game in October when otherwise they wouldn't be. But I would rather...
Or three in the case of the AL.
Well, yeah. I would rather maintain the integrity of team that deserves to be in the postseason rather than give some middling team a shot at spoiling. I don't know. Call me old fashioned. I don't know.
Fancy. How fancy.
Okay. So if you want to do a know your stat, are we going to do that?
I don't know.
Do we have time?
I don't know that we have time.
All right. Well, then.
Long already.
All right, well, let's do last week's trivia question.
Last week's trivia question. Who was the first player to hit 50-plus home runs for two different teams? I think we are also giving extra credit if you can name the other people who have done this beyond the first, but I have to get the first in order to receive those extra credits.
Who was the first player to hit 50 home runs for two different teams? Now, I think I No, actually, somebody on here.
We have has what I was thinking.
Jarhead 322 says Mark McGwire.
Mark McGwire is an excellent guess.
That's what I was thinking.
Certainly achieved that, but he was not the first.
Okay, so he did do it, not the first. Tim in Del Mar, California says Giancarlo Stanton, aka Mike Stanton.
I don't believe that he has.
He didn't do it with the Marlins.
I don't believe so.
All right.
At least his name didn't show up in the list that I was looking.
Well, even if he did, he wouldn't be first.
He wouldn't have been the first. If McGwire wasn't the first, certainly Giancarlo Stanton.
All right. Scott in Oakland says, "I'm pretty sure this is a trick question. Oh, it's got to be Willie Mays." For the New York Giants in 55. Oh, and then for the SF Giants in 65.
Yes.
Oh, because we did do a bit of a trick question last time.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. But I don't believe that the New York Giants and the San Francisco Giants qualify as two different teams.
I'm looking at it. He did hit 50 for both.
Absolutely, he did. Absolutely, 100% he did. But are those truly two different teams? And
okay.
He still wouldn't have been the first.
Really? Wow, all right. Well, it's definitely not the Babe.
Not the Babe.
Sam in Emeryville says, "I know Hack Wilson was the first major league guy to hit 50 whose name wasn't Babe Ruth, so I'm going to say Hack Wilson."
Great guess, but no. He didn't do it for two different teams.
Let's see here. Yeah, indeed. Hack Wilson was the first player, aside from Babe Ruth, to hit 50 home runs in a season when he hit 56 in 1930. Wow, that year he also put up a ridiculous and still record 191 RBIs. Wow.
That's got to be nice to always be batting when people are on base.
Good Lord, I would love to have him on my fantasy team. That's amazing. Hack Wilson,
it really is.
How many total bases? I can't even imagine. Carlos in Torrance, California says, "Love the show, guys, and love old baseball trivia. I got this question wrong at a sports bar trivia one night and never forgot it. I forget the teams, but it's Jimmy Fox."
Is that right? Correct.
Wow.
Jimmy Fox was the first player to hit 50 home runs for two different teams.
Jimmy Fox led the majors with 58 home runs in 1932 for the Philadelphia Athletics, and then in 1938 won an AL MVP for Boston with 50 home runs and 175 RBIs. What is going on?
Hall of Fame.
That's not just small ball. This guy's hitting 50 jacks and still getting 175 RBIs?
Yeah. Well,
Jesus Christ. They had steroids back then?
You got people on base in front of you.
Even Barry never did that. Good Lord.
Look at the OPS of the guys sitting in front of him.
Yeah, well. Sure. Good Lord.
Yeah, and for the record, McGwire and the other person on the list hitting 50 for two different teams is none other than Payrod, Alex Rodriguez.
That's right. I was thinking Griffey. I don't think he hit 50 with Cincinnati, but he definitely hit 50 back-to-back in Seattle and won back-to-back home run titles, too. That was pretty cool. Wow, Payrod. That's right. But McGwire did it, obviously, with the A's and then the Cardinals.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Sammy Sosa played for the Cubs his whole career, or what?
No, he didn't. He played for the White Sox as well, but by then he wasn't on steroids or cork bats at that
deflated
point, so.
That won't happen. Let that be a lesson to you, kids. If you're going to start steroids, finish with steroids, okay? All
right. Retire when you come off.
That brings us to this week's. There you go, Carlos. We're going to send you a t-shirt. Congrats. Email us your address if you're so daring. Let us know. This week's trivia question, what do you got for me this week?
Well, this week, a little bit more modern, perhaps.
Certainly, okay, that's good. I hope so.
Certainly a little bit more.
I know
more,
it took
a little bit
pub
more West
trivia
Coast
to win this last one. Yeah.
Well, hey, pub trivia sometimes will
you
come
know,
in useful.
It pays dividends.
As long as all that beer you're drinking doesn't kill those memory connections.
When in doubt, if it's like a slugging or something, you know, pick Babe Ruth. If you're wrong, go with Hack. Hack yeah. Wilson. Well, you know,
he definitely has some.
Oh no, Jimmy strategy. Fox. Sorry, Jimmy Fox. Whoops, I thought it was. All right, one of those three.
Yeah.
If it's pitching, go with Nolan Ryan. All right, what do you got for me?
Who is the only manager ever to win a division title with five different teams? Only one manager in the history of baseball has managed to win a division title with five different teams. Who is he? Bonus points for getting the teams right.
Ooh,
too.
Wow, that's like a five-pronged question. That's pretty tough. Who is the only manager to win five division titles with five different teams? Let us know. Email us baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Leave the answer on Twitter, on Apple Comments, Podomatic. You know where to find us. On that note, from San Francisco, California, I am Adam Nelson.
And I am Samuel Paul. Remember, baseball is life. The rest, just details.
Go watch some baseball.